This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Try to put on the show.
A little more updates on the story this morning. The Tennessee Titans have had multiple positive tests for the virus COVID-19. That they've been sent home, players and coaches, from the facility until at least Saturday. They played Minnesota in Sunday's game. The Vikings, who, according to reports, don't have any positive tests, have also been sent home out of precaution to try and stem a possible spread, as we're dealing with, and what appears it could be the first sort of virus outbreak in the NFL since teams returned at training camp and began preparations for the year.
I feel that the NFL is going to have to make a schedule change, and that might, I think, best case scenario, involve pushing back the playoffs 1 week, because there might be multiple games that end up having to be rescheduled. That's definitely going to throw a big wrench in the one team getting the bye scenario going into the playoffs. But honestly, that's, I think, the only approach that you can have. Say there are cancellations this weekend, seeing as two teams are now evacuating their facilities.
Let's not use term evacuated.
That's what they
said. Sounds so dire. I know. I read it. I was like, come on. It's not like they were like, COVID-19. It's Danny and Gallant. It's time for us to bring in Blue, Brock Heward for Blue 42.
Here we go. This is Coors Light's Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, G, U corner, halfback, flat, on two. Ready, right.
Blue 42 is brought to you by Coors Light. The mountains turn blue at 42 degrees.
Blue 42!
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42! Blue 42!
Morning, Brock. How are you now?
Oh, always a fun day, isn't it? You just never know in this world what you're going to wake up to, what the headline is, where this thing is going. And oh, by the way, a debate tonight that should be awfully lively. So yeah, just a blast, brother. How are you?
Doing wonderful.
Can I make one point about the debate? And this doesn't have anything to do with the politics of either side. Can we not promote the presidential debates as if they're an NFL game? Like, where it's all of a sudden, he's coming in here after 4 years. The upstart with huge, like, all of these ads seen during the games were awful. Like, just horrible. The most important election. If you're like, come on. Don't use football sports terminology buildup like this is Breeze versus Manning.
Put some montage in the background.
If you're going to promote it, the only thing I'd like it promoted with, Danny, is the Joe Capp Sportsmanship Awards from the CFL.
Where Joe Capp, did he swing the cane or did the other dude
swing the cane?
And it was like Berlusconi.
Yeah, the other guy swung the cane, and then Cap just cold cocked him. Yeah, it was screamed sportsmanship.
Fifth Ward D's on each other.
I'm gonna have to look this one up. Question number one, Brock: is anyone good on defense in the NFL this year?
Ooh, yeah, Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's pretty good on defense this year. After, you know, just a little bit of a step back a season ago with no Ben Roethlisberger, and they trade for Minkah Fitzpatrick early in the season, difference-making safety. You know, they've continued to add and draft and develop very well on that side of the ball, and that is one of the few units that in that front seven reminds me of a front seven of 20 years ago that is just physical, that is just really difficult to move and you know, try to be efficient against. So I would say, just kind of from a matchup purpose, I was chatting with DJ before jumping on with you guys, and you know, I was supposed to have the Vikings and Texans this week, and we'll see now what's going to happen with the Vikings and everything else. And the Texans are 0-3, right? The Texans are 0-3, having lost to Kansas City, having lost to Baltimore, and then ultimately Pittsburgh as well. And, you know, the Pittsburgh would be a team in the defense that would be, I think, a challenge for Russell. Not many of them out there. That's almost how I look at it, Paul, is it's not who's playing elite defense. I'm almost looking at it through the optics of, okay, if the Seahawks and Russell matched up with anybody, who would give them maybe the most challenge or trouble? And I think Pittsburgh would be a pretty difficult matchup, though at the corner, they're not elite. So I think DK and Tyler would still have their way and plenty of opportunities. But But to your point, man, it is a challenge to tackle. It's a challenge to defend. And it's a challenge to cover in today's NFL. As advanced as passing trees are getting, as good as quarterback play is, as teams are playing more and more in space and feasting on matchups. And I don't, you know, I asked Pete, remember last year or 2 years ago, has it ever been harder to play defense in the NFL? And his answer then was no. And I would say I think it's even more difficult in 2020.
Man, that looked like last night that Baltimore's running a 22 caliber offense in a 357 Magnum World, Brock.
Yep.
This is like the third time I've tried my armaments metaphor. I think that one landed.
That looked like Lamar really does not, in year three, have a grasp of protections and like growth and development that I would certainly would like to see in year three of him playing, especially off an MVP year. And I think it was Jeff Schwartz, my buddy Jeff Schwartz on Twitter, who highlighted a play at the end of the game. It was just an empty set five-man protection, and he had no clue who was blocked, where it was blocked, what his outlets and hot looks were and answers were. And, man, there were a number of times. And Steve Spagnuolo is a good defensive coordinator, but I wouldn't even say, Danny, it was that elaborate. You know, you're right. It is. It's run. It's pretty basic and not an impressive effort in the growth and development of Lamar Jackson last night.
Question two. All right, Brock, I'm going to break my own rule here because usually when people ask me about this, I just say, well, you have to understand it's Pete Carroll's defense. And that's it. Is it time to start talking about a different defensive coordinator?
Whew. Yeah, I mean, Danny, it's been rough, man. It's been
brutal.
It's been rough. And Ken Norton is, and you always hate to preface these things, right? Oh, he's a great guy and a tremendous leader, and the players
so
love him.
Skip
and
it.
All that's very true. But in a bottom line business, to my point right there about Lamar Jackson, where is the growth and development? Right? Where is the growth and development of either individual players or the system over now? What is this, his third year?
Third year
overseeing the defense.
Yes.
And I can't say, Danny, that I've seen growth and development in the system, and even out of necessarily particular players, you know, within that system. Yes, Shaquille Griffin had a nice interception. Gives up a couple plays in that game that, you know, were rookie-esque. Like, you just got to stay on top. I mean, you know the scheme and what's being asked of you. We obviously, you know, have seen other DBs and other safeties come through here and get cut and not ever really grow and develop. The linebackers, right? If we've seen growth and development out of that crew other than Bobby, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's a challenge. The numbers are alarming. And I was chatting with a couple defensive guys over the last couple days that I trust a lot, that I know watch a lot of film. And I think if you ask them that question and they weren't on the record, they'd say, this is a problem. Yeah, I mean, this is not good. This is not good football. And I know in sitting down with Pete, and you guys did it yesterday, over the decade or so that Pete's here, you know, when there's had to be fixes like in the run game, right, where they went through some stretches during a season and you have to get that right, or where you have to fix this aspect of the passing defense against tight ends and you got to get that right. Danny, there's a wholesale of issues, man, when you're giving up 430 passing yards a game. That's a bad deal. And the most alarming is in year three, I can't say that there's growth and development. So if this continues, I don't think and can't imagine there'd be a year four.
Assuming no midseason changes, how does this defense adapt and try to turn itself into something that can occasionally get stopped, seeing as we haven't seen that the first couple weeks?
Well, I think they're top five in blitz pressure of five or more. I was looking at those numbers last night.
Adams, though, that's a big loss.
Yep. I mean, a lot of it is Jamal, but you know, you're bringing five or more, I think 38% of the time on the season, right around there. They've been right around 34 to 40 in the three games. So one out of three times, you're having to bring five-plus people. So that was the answer this year compared to last year, right, where they sat in base, they didn't pressure as much, they got gashed and gave up more yards per play than any of Pete's defenses and everything else. So the answer was, well, let's get more aggressive. But if you're going to do that, guess what you have to have on the back end? You have to have linebackers and corners that can play true man-to-man, lockdown man-to-man. Who do you feel comfortable with playing one-on-one man coverage, Paul Gallant? If you're an elite NFL receiver, you're a good NFL receiver, who scares you trying to cover you one-on-one in the Seahawks defense right now?
Honestly, maybe Quentin Dunbar. Yep. But even then, and I heard your call of this, Brock, during the Bills and the Rams game. We're even seeing guys like Jalen Ramsey, who called Josh Allen trash, getting yep. basically worked in the end zone and yep. making bad plays out there.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, it's hard. It's hard to play defense. Hard to play DB. It's hard when you don't have any minicamp, any training camp, any full live stuff. You know, receivers and quarterbacks, guess what they can do the last 6 months? They can go out and throw. And they can work on that precision and all that timing. How many DBs have elite quarterbacks and wide receivers where they get to go out and cover day after day, week after week, month after month? It doesn't happen. Right? Very difficult for those guys to do. They can run. They can do their agilities. They can do their mirror drills. They can do their shadow drill. They can do all of that. But as far as like the live bullets and really having to cover and defend, very difficult to do. And then Shaquille Griffin and certainly in Trey Flowers, right? And KJ, if he's got to cover man-to-man right now at this stage of his career, yeah, there's some challenges. So, you know, that's a conundrum you're in. You want to pressure? Great. You want to leave people one-on-one? No. Then what are you going to do? Play zone? All right. Rush four? Can't get home. I mean, it's a challenging situation the defense finds itself in right now.
Question number three. Earl Thomas is possibly on the verge of signing with the Houston Texans. The Seahawks safety situation is now one where you don't know when Jamal Adams is coming back. You obviously lost Marquise Blair for the year. Lano Hill's dealing with a back injury. Is Earl Thomas someone that the Seahawks should have maybe given a call to?
I don't think so. Yeah, I just don't think at this stage of the game you're going to want to bring that in. I don't know, frankly, how him and Jamal would get along either. And we talked about that big foam finger to the sidelines, you know, last two seasons ago. And I know this is an organization that forgives. I know Pete forgets. I know that he moves forward. But yeah, I just don't think so, Paul. I just don't think that's a direction you go. I think he will likely sign with the Texans. I think that's probably a better fit for Earl. And remember, Earl's got a say in this too. And Earl can look at it and go, yeah, that's not a tenable spot. I there's too much bad blood. I don't think I can sit and work for Pete Carroll and do that. So we all look at it from the Seahawks perspective, but I'd be very curious looking at it from the player perspective too. And very likely he may be one of the first that says, I don't think so. Others have said, yeah, and I'll come on back. But his personality, and he may be the type, as hard-headed as he is, to say, yeah, even if I don't have other good opportunities, I just don't see myself fitting with Pete again.
You know, I had heard when he was a free agent, because the market was not what he anticipated when it opened, when he ended up signing with Baltimore, that he had broached the idea of, like, maybe I'd like to go back to Seattle. That if they were willing to give me sort of what I had, like, not give me a raise on what I was making, that I'd be interested in going back. I'm not looking for a market-setting contract anymore. Kind of just pay me about what he ended up getting in Baltimore, which was the going rate for top safeties.
Yeah.
And Seattle was like, nah.
Yeah. You know, I that one, just for some reason, that's just a gut more than anything else. Not even an X's and O's, Paul, or a roster construction. And Danny, did I answer the Ken Norton well enough? By the way, you're not going to fire him midseason. I don't think there's anybody on the staff that is ready to assume that position. I don't think, you know, the secondary coach, I don't think Clint Hurd, I don't think you have linebacker. I mean, Ken's, I don't think you have anybody on that defensive side. And I don't think Pete at this stage is also one to say, hey, give me that play card and let me divert all my attention to get myself ready to prep and call the defensive side of things. So I don't think you're making a change this year, but this can't continue. This continues at this rate. There's no way he could be back for year four.
It's the exact way I would answer it, Brock, which is that, hey, we've seen enough. It's not going to be different under him. I don't think they're going to make a change midseason. I just don't think that's a possibility, but they do need to do something different. Wade Phillips is out there.
Yeah, that's just so counter schematically.
I know.
I think everything.
Try something different. Well, let's go. Let's try something new.
Not in season.
Resume speaks for itself.
That's true. It is. You can't do it in season. You're right.
Can't do it in. Yeah, can't do it in season. I did hear people say maybe an outside consultant comes in. Remember, Mike Pettine came in a couple years ago, and. And I think that was Mr. Allen that kind of looked at that and said, hey, why don't we get a fresh set of eyes on just a very different system and a very different, you know, that. But that was an off season, you know. Yeah. Maybe you bring somebody in season as a consultant, you know, to say, geez, what are we teaching here on some of these techniques? What, you know, how are we defending, you know, this kind of thing? How can we, you know, continue to utilize Jamal, put him in the best spot while minimizing some of the things that he doesn't do great? So maybe from a consultant, but you're not firing, you're not turning it over to anybody else. Can't imagine Pete necessarily taking over the play calling duties. So I think for this season, it is what it is.
That is Blue 42. It's brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light. Here, in the meantime, here's one thing that I would say. After copious amounts of film study on my own, it seems that Seattle's defensive pressures like toggle between blitz, no blitz, blitz, no blitz. I don't know if anybody else is studying it as closely, and maybe other opponents aren't looking at it with that sort of fine-tooth comb. Yes. But maybe if they could alternate, like they talk about pitch sequencing for pitchers, right? Like pitch sequencing, like change it up, be a little less predictable. Maybe that's one thing that could be tried instead of just, hey, did we blitz last play? No, let's blitz this play. Okay.
Hey, that's good, Danny. Hey, can I say one more thing? And just to Jess, and I don't know if this is out of school or out of turn, but I saw her tweet yesterday. And let me just say to Jessamyn McTyre, there has been no better teammate, no more of a bulldog that will have your back at all costs, that believes in you and the people around you, and just makes, you know, everybody better around you, as Jess did and has done for 11 years. And so excited for your next venture, Jess. But I've said before, like Olin Krutz was my favorite football teammate because he'd go at the neck of anybody that tried to you know, come against you. Jessamyn, you have much the same as a radio teammate and a partner in this. Like, don't you dare come at anybody on my team, or I'm going to Olin Krutz you and come right at you, Jess. So
that is probably the highest praise I could possibly receive. I am Olin Krutz.
Yes.
I'm going to get an okay tattoo.
Yeah, but you haven't hit anybody in the jaw or broke jaws behind the scenes, but you certainly have.
You would.
Just figuratively.
You've inspired people. You've encouraged people. You've built people up. You've been an unbelievable teammate for a long time, Jess.
Thanks, Brock. And I wasn't going to cry happy tears today, so thanks for that. Between you and Angie Mintink, I'm spent.
Get ready. There's more coming.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. But Brock, so have you. And I've watched you grow from first-time radio host to big-time broadcaster over this entire time. We were OGs. So I'm just blessed to have had the time with the people, because I don't just go protect people because they're on my team. They got to be good.
Yeah. Well, heck of a teammate. You are going to be sorely missed. You're going to be added, you know, the big time. And at least you're staying in town, too. So we'll still get to see you, and you'll still impact so many lives here in our community, Jess. So thank you.
Thank you, Brock.
You got it.
Brock, thank you very much.
Thanks,
we'll look forward to catching up with you on Thursday.
We will do it. See you, boys.
If you missed yesterday's announcement, we'll continue doing stuff over the course of this week. Jessamyn McTyre is moving on from 710 ESPN Seattle. She will be working at Q13. Tomorrow is her last day. She's been one of the founding members of this station, one of the people who really one of the threads that runs through the development and expansion of a lineup from a couple of shows to being an all-day program and having what, 13 hours each day of live local radio programming. We're really grateful. We will miss her incredibly, but mm-hmm. we're really excited for the next opportunity at Q13.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, it is. Well, it's bittersweet, I guess, is the word. You know, what was unprecedented was the 2020 word, unprecedented. Mine is bittersweet as I move on to a new opportunity. And I guess I never want to be someone who's running from something. And everyone should know that there is no way in heck I am moving away from 710 per se. I'm just moving towards something that offers, you know, a new opportunity, a place where I can grow. Not that I wasn't at 710, but in a different way. So thank you again. And I think we've got really good people. The best part about Seattle is we have such a tight-knit community here that we already know everybody over there. I'm going to be right across the lake, and I'm going to be right here with all of you still.
Well, congratulations. We are going to miss you, but everybody here is so excited.
Thanks. That's great. Been overwhelmingly positive. So thanks.
Really cool. It is Danny and Gallant. We're going to try the gas face here again in just a second to pan some of the things that we have absolutely hated over the course of the NFL weekend. I do feel compelled to explain Brock's Olin Krutz metaphor.
Yes.
So Olin Krutz was Brock's center. He played, he was from Hawaii. Olin Krutz is one of the toughest dudes who's ever played in the NFL. They believe he was a second round pick, might have been a third round pick, by the Chicago Bears, had an incredible NFL career. Olin was a tough dude, and Olin had several fights with teammates. Like, he's just a tough dude. And I think one of my favorite stories that ever, in 2006, I was writing a story about how Olin was someone that you didn't mess with. Unfortunately, in college, Olin had gotten into a fight with a teammate whose jaw he broke, and it changed that guy's. And I ended up talking to the player, Suki Wiggs, who I believe still lives in town. It was a O'Day High School football player. It was a brutal thing for that team. But talking about how people generally loved Olin as a teammate, even as he'd gotten into several fights with teammates that had injured those players. Brock told me a story that when they were freshmen, Brock had told Olin Krutz that his mother was very attractive, that your mother is very, very pretty. And Brock had then explained to me that Olin chased him around the dining hall there at Haggett Hall, which is one of the dormitories. As a reporter, and I was working at the Seattle Times, like, you don't let a story like that pass. So that was basically the intro to the Olin Krutz is the kind of guy that Brock called as one of the best teammates he ever had, and also someone who chased Brock around a dormitory cafeteria because Brock had commented on the attractiveness of his mother. After the story ran, I get a call from Olin Krutz, who says, "Hey, I don't think you're going to give me Brock's phone number, but here's my cell phone number. Can you tell him to call me? Because I want him to stop telling stories that make me look like a lunatic." At which point, what occurred to me in my head is like, yes, because it's totally normal to call a reporter and say, "Hey, deliver this number to this guy," because that doesn't make you look like a lunatic at all. Nope. Like, that's completely
totally normal. I've seen that all the
this
time.
This guy who's on your team.
He had been. It's always stuck out to me. And now I probably have to worry about Olin calling me to inform me. But seriously, Olin Krutz was one of, and any of the players that you talk to off of that offense, that most guys that have played with him at any point, he went to New Orleans at one point in his career as well, one of the original just tough dudes, an unbelievable teammate. So it was very, very high praise, Jess. It is Danny and Gallant. Coming up next, we're going to distribute gas faces, more blown fourth quarter leads, one team that should fire its coach for a decision everybody knew he had to make, and then the third one is going to be someone who's kicking himself over punting. That's next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
It'll make you do a double take. Perhaps it will singe your nasal hairs. Something happens that you just cannot let pass without making a, "Okay, I see exactly what happened here, and I can't believe you did that." It is the gas face. Something that we do each and every Tuesday at 8:30 here on Danny and Gallant. And, well, let's provide a little bit of an introduction to exactly how we get started.
Today's lecture deals with the gas face.
And the gas face is what you do when you can't believe what you just saw. Something happens and you just can't believe it, Paul.
Is the response that you immediately have when you see a dumb decision. And in the NFL and in college football, we generally see it many times over the course of a weekend. Coaches doing bizarre, dumb, inexplicable things.
Let's get going. All right, I'm going to start with the Chicago Bears. The Chicago Bears in the second half of their third game benched their quarterback, Mitchell Trubisky. I don't even think this is a bad decision. But if he was on that short of a leash, why in the world was he your quarterback? They are undefeated, and they've shelved their starting quarterback in favor of Nick Foles. If I'm a Bears fan, I'm irate that my team didn't go out and look at Cam Newton, didn't go look out at Andy Dalton. There are a number of quarterbacks out there that are specifically better than Nick Foles. Then spent the entire month of August pumping up the tires on Mitchell Trubisky. Like, what was the GM talking about? The confidence that you saw? And the leash was so short, Paul, that they didn't even lose a game before that dude lost his job.
It makes me think, Danny, that this was not Matt Nagy's decision. I think this was Ryan Pace's decision. I think it was foisted upon him that he needed to give Mitchell Trubisky a couple of games. But I think Nagy was like, hey, okay, let's go to Foles immediately.
Nagy didn't want him at all. And Pace was like, nah, we've got to at least see what we've got here. We've got to give him a chance to show he's the right guy.
And Trubisky, to his credit, after this game said, I gave my coach the opportunity to bench me, which is such a polite way of falling on your sword.
I believe that the play that ended it for Trubisky was a third and one at the end of the first half, and Anthony Miller came open, and they threw deep. They got exactly what they wanted, and it looked like Trubisky did exactly what they wanted him to do and overthrew the dude by 2 yards. And I think at that point, like, if there was a final straw, Nagy was like, we can't draw up something that gets any better than that. And if our quarterback, even when he knows what the right play is, then can't make that play, we have to bench him. There are so many teams that do these things where they become, whether it's pot committed or you just, this has to work, so we're going to go through with it. Nobody thought this was going to work, and it didn't work.
I've made this joke about Marcus Mariota before. I think Trubisky is the second coming of Mariota, top draft pick that is great at running but not good at throwing. I feel like Taysom Hill possibilities are there. Or you just move him to running back, seeing as Tariq Cohen just was lost for the season. And I'm actually serious here. He's very athletic, Mitchell Trubisky. I'd be curious to see him in another position. Quarterback ain't it.
That idea of Taysom Hill, because the reason Taysom Hill works is because they don't care if he gets hurt. Like, he gets smacked in games. Mm-hmm. Like, he appears, his number one trait is that he's a fairly accurate quarterback. He's a big enough dude, and he can take a hit. So they're just like, dude, we're going to put him in the worst possible situations, and he can still throw it, so defenses aren't ready to do it, because anytime you have a quarterback, you're like, well, we don't want our quarterback getting hit like that. They don't care. Take that approach with Trubisky. Look, Mitch, we don't care if you get hurt anymore. I like that.
My gas face is going to go to Doug Peterson after the second Eagles-Bengals tie of the decade. The last time we saw these two teams tie, it was because, actually, I guess it was last decade. Donovan McNabb famously said, oh, I didn't know that you could tie at the end of a regular season game or at the end of a playoff game. He thought that ties could still happen or in the Super Bowl. So, bad moment for Donovan McNabb. The Syracuse education not helping him out there as much as it should have. But anyway, back to Doug Peterson. The Eagles had a chance to give Jake Elliott, who's got some range, he has a 61 career long as far as field goals go, to kick a 59-yard field goal at the end of overtime, less than a minute to go. But unfortunately, in true Eagles fashion, a false start is called, and all of a sudden that becomes a 64-yard attempt. Doug Peterson, instead of kicking the field goal or going for it on 4th and 12 with less than a minute, did not want to give, I'm not going to say fat Randy, large Randy Bullock, an attempt to get the game-winning kick on the other side of things. Not the nickname I've given him, but it's a nickname that is definitely in NFL circles.
Are you serious?
Fat Randy.
Fat Randy.
I covered Randy Bullock in Houston, and that guy, the poor guy, that was the nickname that was given to him. Whatever the case, they did not want the Eagles to see Randy Bullock and the Bengals get a last-second field goal attempt. They were cool with the idea of a tie. In the NFC East, honestly, with how garbage it's been thus far, maybe not the worst strategy in the world. Here's Doug Peterson talking about deciding to punt in what ultimately ended in a 23-23 tie on Sunday.
Yeah, the decision there, one of two things. You can either attempt it on fourth down and try to go for it. We tried to go for the field goal, the game winner. That was the thing. We were going to go for the game winner with the kick. Felt comfortable with Jake, had the wind. The false start backed us up, so we just said, hey, let's just punt the football here. We didn't want to give them the ball, towards midfield, or even a chance to go for it on fourth down and long, incomplete pass, something like that. They get the ball short field, they could kick a field goal and win the game. So, just made that decision. Hopefully, something positive might have come out of the punt.
You could hear as he's talking, he's just like, oh, wait a second, is this really what I wanted to do? So then yesterday, Danny, here is a reevaluation of his decision, Doug Peterson.
Either way you slice it, my decision, looking back, I probably would have elected to maybe go for it in that situation and try a ball down the field.
Yeah, maybe you should have thought about that. By the way, remember this happened last season where the Seahawks, on a 4th-and-2 at their own 45 with a minute 56 left in overtime against the 49ers, they decided to punt the football. Michael Yes. Dixon punts it, and somehow the 49ers go 3-and-out in like basically 30 seconds, and the Seahawks get the ball back, and they ultimately end up winning it. This Yes. is the dangerous line that you walk across in overtime if you decide that you're going to punt the ball away at the end of a game.
The math that's there, the Eagles have been praised as being one of the more advanced teams in their game decisions. I mean, using game theory and some other sort of analytically based input on those. It is, look, Seattle, I typically think punts too much, but there's points like the one you just mentioned where it's like, it's actually turned out okay for them. Like, it's actually, like, they've come out in the right decision. I would argue that even the game against Green Bay, I thought that their thought process, the risks that they took, they got 2 third-and-longs to get the ball back, and they just couldn't get a stop.
Right.
I thought it was pretty sound, but yeah. If your coach screws up, would you want him to admit it? Like, if your coach screws up on Sunday, do you want him to tell you that on Monday, or do you want him to pretend he was right?
I don't mind it. As long as it's not cliche speak, it's on me. Yes, I'm okay with it. I have no problem with somebody owning up to when they're wrong. In fact, I think I like it. I don't know that I feel better about Doug Peterson going forward if he were to admit, though, that he made the wrong decision there. It's tricky. Would you rather lose or tie? I think I'd rather lose.
Ties? Oh, no, no. No, ties
are gross.
Is much better. No, no.
I know
no,
they're better.
Ties are much better.
I know they're better, but they're gross. Like, it's shameful.
Seattle's had one tie in its history, and it was actually a pretty awesome game, and I came away from it, and it was like, it stinks. Everybody missed field goals, but Bobby Wagner jumped over the line. Like, all this crazy stuff happened in the game. It also was responsible for one of the better quotes ever. Yeah.
Was that against Cincinnati as well?
No, it was Arizona.
Arizona.
6-6 tie.
Okay.
Thursday night football.
Oh, boy. 6-6. Yeah. Goodness. Thank God we didn't watch that game this offseason.
It included Hauschka missing, and it wasn't a long field goal. Like, it was like a 35-yard attempt, and he just hooked it
Oh. So
bad. Maybe more than I've ever seen. And Hauschka had a problem kicking in Arizona. So he was talking about the footing there. And I heard that the holder, John Ryan's response to him was like, dude, you didn't even hit the net. Diminish Eddie. My final gas face goes to ESPN officiating analyst John Perry. This has become a staple of all broadcasts. John Perry is the worst. Of all these dudes, he's the worst. He's supplanted my
broadcasters.
Oh, they bring him in. Terry McAuley on Sunday Night Football is the best. And Chris Collinsworth uses him as sort of this de facto, come in and explain this to me because I don't understand what you officials do in these situations. Like, he's like, Terry, it's great. It's humorous. McAuley will tell you when they've goofed up. Even this week, Mike Pereira, who usually rubber stamps everything that the officials do, came in and said they screwed up in the Buffalo Rams game where there was an interception that shouldn't have been an interception. They awarded it to him. John Perry last night comes back and tells us about the track record of John that little hussy, who was the chief referee. How many years? How well respected? I don't want baseball cards. I don't want baseball card information on the officials. I don't need to know their background. I don't need to know anything about their crew. I don't want to know anything about that. I want you to say what you think they're going to make a decision on when it goes to replay or before it goes to replay. Like, there's a very narrow thing. Did they get this call right? Will they reverse it? That's all I want to know. I don't want to know anything else. And Perry, not only does he not tell you that when it goes to it, but he constantly is telling you how hard it is to be an official and the tough decision that's being made. No!
Yeah.
Just give me an analysis of the officiating. I don't want any sort of explanation or defense of them.
This is why I miss Sean McDonough on the call of Monday Night Football, because he would have made a sarcastic comment about Perry.
Oh, really?
McDonough was somewhat brutally sarcastic in the Monday Night Football year that he did, and he didn't have the greatest chemistry with John Gruden, which I think did him in. But yes, that guy does not pull punches, and I would have loved to see the interaction between them, because with Levy and that whole crew, like, they're fine, they're perfectly adequate, but you don't at first start saying, "Okay, John, no one cares."
Yeah, somebody like, it's terrible. It's an it adds nothing to the broadcast. That crew is fine. Like, they're not the best. Levy, Greasy, who I thought I wouldn't like, but is okay. And Lewis Riddick, who I really do like. Like, they're totally fine. They're not the worst. They're totally fine.
Admission. I ironically miss Joe Tessitore.
Oh, no.
I miss the unnecessary excitement.
Well, let's see if Lamar Jackson has a response now. Patrick, Showtime Mahomes, show it here, us who runs the league.
One of the greatest extra point attempts in NFL history.
God, I don't miss that for a second. It is Danny and Gallant. The Seahawks are 3-0 for just the second time in Pete Carroll's tenure. But there are some uncomfortable truths that we'll talk about next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Before we get into uncomfortable truths coming out of yet another Seahawks victory, they're 3-0. Jermaine Kearse, former Seahawk wide receiver, announced his retirement via Instagram. In the post, he wrote, "Seattle, as a hometown kid, it was a complete honor to represent you guys out there on the field. Thank you so much for your endless support throughout my football career. It was an honor to put on that Hawks uniform, and I'm so grateful I was able to help bring our first Super Bowl home, something we will never forget." Clutch plays, Jermaine Kearse, that's what he did, especially in the playoffs. And happy trails, Jermaine, to a very, very successful career in the league.
Probably the most, I would argue, the most underrated hometown product at pretty much every level. Comes out of Lakes High School, was one of the most productive receivers in University of Washington history, yet you have people that argue and maintain that he was some sort of underachiever and harp on drops. He is an undrafted rookie free agent who signs with the Seattle Seahawks, promptly goes on to have some of the most memorable catches in this franchise's history, whether it is the game winner in the NFC Championship game.
That one's my fave.
That's awesome. He also had an incredible Super Bowl catch in which he essentially performed 360-degree spins in opposite directions.
That one was insane.
The number of different clutch catches that guy had over the course of his time with the Seahawks was awesome, and yet you still had people complaining about him. It was unbelievable. Ends up going to the Jets, suffered a really brutal leg injury with the Lions. I don't know if people remember that, and I knew that he was trying to come back from that. Jermaine Kearse is an awesome story of success and a true sort of hometown product from the state of Washington. And congratulations on an incredible career. My best wishes to you and your family, Jermaine.
Same. Very, very cool post to see today. And I think we'll see a lot of well wishes his way the rest of the day. I want some well wishes for these uncomfortable Seahawk truths. Danny, yes, the Seahawks are 3-0. I do not want to be the whiny little talking head here, but we do not ignore in victory what we would beat up in defeat, Danny. And this secondary, should we slap ourselves in the face retroactively for believing that this secondary, after adding Jamal Adams and adding Quentin Dunbar, could be LOB-esque this year? Because it's been a rough go.
It has been a rough go. No, we shouldn't. We've had injuries. That's been part of it, right? Like there've been injuries. Quentin Dunbar wasn't available.
Dunbar
goes out.
Adams.
Jamal Adams is now hurt. Quandre Diggs gets kicked out of a game. So yeah, there's been some extenuating circumstances. I also do believe that when you're up double digits in the second half, all passing yards that are surrendered in that point should count for half.
I get it. NFL record though for three games.
It should count half, but you're undefeated.
Yeah.
You're undefeated.
Okay. This is the uncomfortable truth. The secondary, ugh.
It feels like at any point I say, like I'm trying to say it's not bad, and I don't want it. But if you're 3-0, and I don't think that part of the defense can be any worse, I do think it's reasonable for it to be better. Is it that big a problem?
If it couldn't be any worse, yes, it is that big of a problem. You just said it.
But they're probably going to get better because they can't get any worse.
Probably.
They're probably going to get better over the next 3 months.
But what if they stay the same? And I think that's a possibility too.
They're 3-0, so if they stay the same, there's no guarantee that they're eventually going to lose, is there?
It hasn't cost him yet.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
Let's go.
Like, he had a really good quarterback. Russell's young. He can carry all. Like, we wanted to let Russ cook. So, well.
All right.
We're just going to forget about doing the dishes for a little bit and see if they stack up in the sink.
Legion of Zoom, baby. Another uncomfortable truth. This one is a strange one for the offense, Danny. Seattle's weirdly been not bad, but not good on third downs. They're converting just 38% of their third downs on offense this year. That's 25th in the NFL. It's a surprising number, and it's a number we saw a lot of on Sunday in a game that Pete Carroll said was a little more difficult than the others have been for Russell Wilson.
Yeah. At the same time, they're scoring at a pretty high clip. I'm not worried about the offense. I am only encouraged about the offense. I think the pass protection has been significantly better than I expected.
Yeah,
given
I agree.
All the changes up front.
I agree, and I will fall on the sword at least through three games on that one. I was really nervous about the offensive line. They've done a very good job.
You give me a choice between having a defense that isn't what we expected and having an offense that isn't what we expected. I'll take the defense every time because they're young, and I think you can make that up as you go. There's very few times that you see a team that doesn't play well on offense early in the year that all of a sudden gets it later. Like that's not something that usually improves over the course of the season or can improve as much as defenses can improve. I like the way their offense is playing. I like the way and the fact the third down conversions that you mentioned, they're not facing that many of them, and some of that is because they're willing to throw on earlier downs. They're not run pass. Like that's not been the pattern, and they're facing fewer third downs because of it. I always get leery when you see a team that has great third down conversion numbers because you're like, well, they're performing really well, but is that sustainable? If usually when a team is succeeding at a historic clip, they don't continue to succeed at the historic clip because that's unusual, which is why it's historic. I'm encouraged that they're not playing over their head right now. The offense is not at some sort of level that you'd say there's no way that they can possibly sustain it unless you think that Russell isn't this good, and I think he's this good.
For what it's worth, they're in the same conversation, though, as the Browns, Vikings, Bears, Broncos, Washington football team, Jets, and Colts. The Colts and Bears somehow both undefeated, perhaps fool's gold there. It's something that I think will get better as the season goes along, as they face more third downs, but Sunday was the most that they faced, 13. They were 5 of 13 on those third downs. What uncomfortable truths have you seen, Danny, especially on Sunday?
Are they running out of bodies? Like, having Ryan Neal, who was on the practice squad until he was promoted on game day, be in the end zone to pick off a pass, and we see Mike Garofalo of the NFL Network said the Seahawks are hosting veteran safety Demarius Randall.
Okay.
And you might remember him with the Green Bay Packers,
right?
That Randall might be coming to visit. Are they running out of bodies? And Lano Hill, if Lano Hill stays healthy, they're okay in the interim here with Jamal Adams probably going to be out for a little bit because of a groin injury. If Lano Hill stays healthy, I think they're okay. But you're now down. I mean, that would be two of the four safeties that you feel good about.
Mm-hmm.
With Adams out and Blair lost for the season. So I'm starting to worry about them running out of bodies. You've lost two strong side linebackers. Jordan Brooks is probably going to miss a few weeks with a sprained MCL. Cody Barton's there, and I think that's okay. But you're starting to run short on bodies. Quentin Dunbar has a knee that it sounds like is going to be consistently sore or hasn't gotten better over the past couple weeks. That's problematic. So I'm starting to worry about them running out of bodies.
It's a little concerning, too, when you start a sentence by saying, well, if Lano Hill, I mean, you're starting to rely on Lano Hill for things. And you, Danny, have seen an interesting pattern with the Seahawks defense when it comes to blitzes, which maybe...
I'm not super pumped about the blitz one play, don't blitz the next. Blitz one play, don't blitz the next. And I want to be careful because part of this might be that I'm not used to seeing Seattle blitz so much. So I'm like, oh my gosh, they're doing this all the time. Whereas, I mean, Pittsburgh blitzes a ton too, and they've got a great defense. But it seems like they're just like, okay, we're going to blitz this play. Do we blitz last play? Nope. Okay, let's play bait. Let's drop back and cover them. It seems, and for a team that's not getting to the quarterback a ton, it seems like there's an awful lot of pressure being thrown at the opposing quarterback.
Yeah, and without Jamal Adams as part of that blitz, how do you continue to create pressure?
We pretend that the four 40-yard completions against the Cowboys were just, oh, Seattle let guys run by him. They're blitzing more. What happens when you blitz more? You get beat. Like, that's what – it's taking a chance. That's why teams – that's why Seattle hasn't blitzed, because they're like, we don't want to give up big plays. They're taking more chances. They're giving up more big plays. This makes sense.
It's Danny and Gallant. Those are the uncomfortable truths that we do not ignore in victory, what we would beat up in defeat. Coming up next, the Seahawks. They don't, as much as we would like to see it. But does anyone play good defense in the NFL in 2020? It's Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN, Seattle.